Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
You better watch out.
You better not cry.
You better not pout, I'm telling you why.
Santa Claus is coming to town.
He sees you when you're in sleep mode.
He knows when you're awake.
He knows when you've been bad or good, so buy a PC and not a Mac this holiday season or any other time, for goodness sake. Oh, come on. Oh, what? What? I thought those were the lyrics. I mean, that's how I learned it.
Hello, and welcome to Lowcast, the best.
Oh, wait, I forgot the Thanksgiving edition intro. Hold on.
Hello. Welcome to the Cultcast,
the gobble gobbliest Apple conversation.
gobbliest.
All week long, y'all.
I'm your host, Airfun Elijah. Joining me today, if Cultcast were turkey, he'd be the dry white meat. Leander Caney is here.
Okay, thanks. Is that a good thing or what?
I mean, it depends what kind of meat you're into. Yeah, I like a little dry white meat. Also with us, every bird needs that succulent, juicy, dark meat. Lewis Wallace is here. Gobble gobble to you, Lewis.
Oh, I can't wait to see what part of the turkey I am.
Here it comes. Here it comes. Also with us.
Here comes the beak.
Also with us. He's like that weird new dessert your aunt brings to dinner, and it turns out you like it. David Pierini back with us after many months. Gobble gobble to you, David.
I'm happy that I wasn't the giblets bag.
Right.
Oh boy, there's a joke in there somewhere.
I'll take the crazy aunt dessert.
There's a joke in there somewhere. I gotta remember that for next year. The giblets bag. Okay, this is our Thanksgiving episode, Cultcast, and boy, what a show do we have for you guys this week. This is gonna be all about the cult of Mac. It's many things. You might be thinking, what is the cult of Mac? Well, Leander's gonna tell us about that, and we're going to talk about some of the best stories inside his new book, The Cult of Mac 2.0, and The Cult of Mac 1.0, which came out, what, like 10 years ago? Leander, how long ago was it?
Yeah, it was about 10 years ago. Yeah, it was. I think it was.
Did it precede the website Cult of Mac, or did it come out after?
It preceded it.
Wow. So it was the beginning of The Cult of Mac.
Indeed.
That idea, you documenting the rabid fandom that exists in the Apple ecosystem. Is that right?
Right?
And now we have version 2.0 coming out, and it's going to be fun because we're going to talk about a few stories here. First of all, Jobs, Steve Jobs, the opera. You knew about Steve Jobs, the jeans, Steve Jobs, the man. We're going to tell you about the the musical Steve Jobs experience you didn't know you needed to see. Also, Kansas Fest, the world's largest gathering of nerds celebrating Apple, swapping old software, hardware, and copies of one of the best magazines, Nibble Magazine, which is a personal favorite of mine. I got a whole stack of them. Also, the story of Alex Jason, a teen who used his lawn mowing money to build one of the most rare and impressive Apple collections. Quite a story there. And then we're going to wrap up with a story about Dmitry Lyshchina. Did I say that right, David?
Sounds right. That's how
okay,
I would pronounce it
enough.
Anyway.
A man who built a career pimping out the iPhones of the rich and famous. And then we'll probably have some other tangential stories sprinkled in here of the craziness that happens within the cult of Mac. Don't you think, Leander?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's so many stories to tell.
There's, oh, yeah.
Hold on. Don't get too enthusiastic.
Okay, yeah. So I was going to start telling a few.
We're not ready to dive in yet. Before we do, let me give a quick thanks to Squarespace for supporting this episode. Do you need a website? Are you trying to promote your skill set, your business? Maybe you want to sell products or services online. You've heard me say it 100 times. I'm going to say it number 101 here. Maybe this time you'll get it. Maybe this time you'll act. If you're ready to get a website set up, head on over to squarespace.com/cultcast to get started. They couldn't make it any easier to get online and build a beautiful website quickly. You just drag and drop all the different elements that you want. You can add videos. You can build beautiful image galleries. You can add your social media. They give you the capability to build a beautiful website quick. And if you want, you can just have it up in minutes, or you can dive in and customize every little thing without having to code or anything. They make everything so easy to do on your own. You won't need any help. And you can maintain the website all by yourself, which is the best part. You won't have to wait on a developer or someone with some kind of website acumen to do it. You can do it yourself, which is going to save you money and time. Check it out at squarespace.com/cultcast. Build a website. See how you like it. If you get stuck, they have great service. They're always there 24 hours a day to help you get unstuck. Build a website. See how you like it. At the end of the 2-week free trial, if you want to keep your website going, you can use code CULTCAST at checkout. You'll save 10% off your first order. If you order of your service, you'll get an additional discount and you'll get a free domain name at squarespace.com/CULTCAST. And the offer code used is CULTCAST at checkout. Okay. Is it 15 years, Lewis? Is that what I'm seeing here?
If you can believe Wikipedia, yeah, 2004.
Well, I believe Leander over, well.
Why are you asking me for? I'm the last person to know.
Yeah, it's not 10.
I can't even remember who wrote that one. Just kidding. I wrote the whole thing myself. Yeah, 2004. That's such a long time ago. I'm getting old,
oh,
man.
My
I mean,
gosh.
You know, my memory is not what it used to be.
I was going to say, I thought Cult of Mac has been around for longer than 10 years, but, you know. You're the guy that wrote it. You would know.
It was a blog at Wired, like, because I used to be a reporter at Mac Week. Remember Mac Week? Did anyone used to subscribe to Mac Week, the world's greatest news weekly for the Macintosh?
I can't say that I have heard of that one.
Well, that's because it folded, back in the early 2000s. And I got a job at Wired.com, and I was like the Apple reporter there. So I started an Apple blog called Cult of Mac, like as a joke, you know. But at the time, Apple was in real trouble, and it was, it was all the Apple fans really that sort of banded together to save the company, and this sort of nascent culture that was living online, and that's what caught my interest, and I reported on that for Wired.com, and then all those stories got compiled into this book.
A lot of people probably don't realize that Cult of Mac used to be part of Wired, and then when did you spin it off into its own thing?
2009.
And built it into the Cult of Mac. I bet they regret that day. They think
well, we had
back
a big
on that
fight over
it,
actually.
Like,
they wouldn't let me do it initially, and said that it claimed it was like, you know, Wired's intellectual property. But then I got a break, and someone I don't know, I can't remember who was it. Someone gave me a break, and they had all these lawyers in New York, and the CEO, and then Cy Newhouse or something like that signed off on it. It was really kind of crazy, you know, the whole Condé Nast brass. So
yeah.
Then I got
was
all the
it,
blessing
Rudy
to
Giuliani,
yeah, right, to sign up on it, and you know it. So then I was able to take it independent.
And I bet they rued the day they let that happen, because now they're looking at the Cult of Mac empire, right. And they're like,
"I know,
what
yeah, Condé Nast is in the is going down. This is Cult of Mac is rising up."
Jeez. Well, it's too late for them, but. Let's talk about the Cult of Mac Empire, because it just keeps getting better. We got this new book coming out, which is an aggregation of all the best Cult of Mac stories since the last book, right? So all the best and bizarre stuff that you guys could find since the last book came out.
This new book is the Cult of Mac 2E, as in second edition.
Oh, is that also a play on like some type of... Oh, the 2E, yes, of course, of course.
And just for another, real quick shameless plug, it's on Amazon right now for pre-order.
It's a beautiful hardbound book,
right? It's a nice-looking
right?
book.
It's like it's almost like a coffee table book, right? It's not like
almost?
A novel.
It is a
almost?
Table book.
Okay, well, I haven't seen it. I don't know.
Wow.
I'm still waiting for my copy. All I saw was the Amazon thing.
That's right. Yeah, sorry, I forgot about that. Yeah, well, you'll be getting one for Christmas, so don't worry about that. probably next Christmas when it's going to discount.
So, yeah. Christmas,
of course,
yeah.
That'll be the digital version.
Kindle version. Okay. So it's a big, beautiful coffee table
book. It's a really nice
book.
Looking book. It's all full color. There's like full color pictures throughout. It's been designed by Derek E., who's a crazy madman of a designer. He got an award for one of the previous books, Cult of iPod, like the best independent book, best design at the Independent Book Awards or something like that. This is a few years ago. But and this thing, he goes into into a cave for like 6 months, and no one can communicate with him. You don't hear a peep out of him. He doesn't respond to emails, doesn't respond to phone calls. He doesn't see his family, nothing, you know. And then out comes this like crazy, crazy book. He has designed every single page, and he made the whole book look like a MacBook, so it's kind of weird. Like, you know, if you look at it on Amazon, there's the first pictures.
I'm going to look at it right now.
Yeah,
here
the
go.
Pictures. I don't. It's hard to sort of see it. And I think the pictures on Amazon don't do it justice.
We have posted a video of the book and how it should be enjoyed, especially the first few pages when you open it up and you see the first page is actually the keyboard.
Right.
Oh.
So it's super clever. And you can't see this. Like, if you look, can you see on the, I don't think it comes across like on the, on Amazon, right? You see, it's like a gray cover with.
Oh, yeah. It looks like a MacBook. Tie.
But once you get the book
in
your hands, it's like, oh my God, this thing's, it does actually look really like a MacBook. And you open it up, and like Dave said, there's a keyboard there. And the inside cover looks like the screen, you know? So, and then as you open it up, you know, it sort of shifts the orientation of the type. So, because it goes from, you know, sort of landscape to portrait. That makes sense?
Right. And we should also mention, it just occurred to me, David, you're here because you helped write the book, which we didn't mention before.
No, that's fine. Yeah. No, a lot of the stories in there, we did interviews with people and talked to them. And it, you know, a lot of times when you work for a website, you're reacting to news, you're reacting to, you know, stories that other places report. And here we, you know, we did some original reporting, interviewed people. They shared with us pictures. It was a, you know, a really great opportunity.
A bunch of stuff got picked up, didn't it, Dave? You know, like, you know, all your reporting on that the kid that we're going to be talking about with who built his own Apple Museum with all his lawnmower money. I mean, that got picked up by the New York Times and a whole bunch of other people, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Leander, let's just dive right in here. The first question being, is there still a cult of Mac? Because things have changed over the last 10 to 15 years, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Like I said, you know, like the first book really kind of came out of that the sort of, you know, the banding together of the all these sort of diehard Apple fans that were really the you know, it was like the last stand, right? Custer's last stand. You know, Apple was really in trouble. Steve Jobs had come back to the company. It wasn't really clear if he was going to save it or not. And you had people who would, you know, like if you went to your local computer store, you know, this is like, I can't remember what it was, like Circuit City back in the day, you know, like, or Sears. I mean, they used to sell computer. Sears was a big retailer, right? So they would go to Sears and the Macs would be sort of like on a dusty shelf at the back and they'd all be like turned off and the salespeople would all be steering people towards the, you know, the cheaper Mac, the Microsoft computers. And so you get people who would volunteer their evenings and weekends to be like salespeople. They'd just hang around by the Macs, you know, they'd switch them on, they'd tidy them up, they'd dust it down. And then when customers came in, they'd try to grab them and pull them back to the Macs. And this is the kind of thing that you'd see like online a lot as well. You know, like there was the Mac evangelist mailing list that was run by Gao Kawasaki that was all full of good news about the Mac instead of bad news, because everything in the newspapers and magazines on web and TV at the time was just bad news about Apple. They were afraid it was going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So there was this like, you know, and having sort of grown up in the 70s in Britain, you know, when it was like there was all these youth subcultures, mods and skins and punks and new romantics. You know, I was fascinated by this idea that there was this sort of this subculture devoted to, you know, a technology company or a brand of computers, you know, the Mac. Because at the time, you know, that was basically, this was before the iPhone and the iPod and all the Apple's other products. So the Mac basically was their only product line or their main product line. I just found it fascinating, you know, that these were like Hell's Angels. These were like, you know, Trekkies.
Hell's Angels. Yeah, they're exactly the same.
Kind of,
yeah.
Were, you know? they talk about their machines, they talk about upgrading them, they talk about the company. They'd, you know, like Macworld was like, this is, you know, they had Macworld twice a year in the States, but they also had Macworld Europe and Macworld Tokyo. And these would sort of be the big gatherings of the clan. So people would take vacations. They'd get married at Macworld. You know, they'd. There was all kinds of.
Wait a second. Now it sounds like you're speaking from personal experience. Did you marry Tracy at Macworld?
No, not me. It wasn't me. But there was definitely David Pogue. You remember David Pogue, the writer? He was a Macworld writer. He officiated. He actually got ordained to officiate at a wedding.
Hilarious.
It was, what's his name? Mac, Sean King and Lisa something. I can't remember their names now. But anyway, so there was this community, and it was sort of defined by the idea that Apple was going to go out of business, right? So this is like a big, this is the kind of thing that bound them together, this kind of fear of Apple going away, and they're going to have to use a horrible, foul, filthy, smelly Microsoft computer. And then since then, you know, it's the complete opposite. Apple's the biggest company in the world. It has super beautiful and successful stores all over the place, and you know, it's It used to be rare to meet another Mac aficionado, you know, another Mac fan. But these days, you know, it's hard to avoid them. You know, everyone's got AirPods in their ears or white earbuds and
or an iPhone. Yeah.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So it's definitely changed. And you know, and we were sort of considering this question: is there a cult of Mac anymore? Is there the Apple subculture? Is it as cohesive as it used to be? And you know, I think you know the conclusion of the book is very definitely yeah. It definitely does still exist. It definitely still is, and it's as strong as ever. It's just, it's bigger, you know, and it's not the same mentality you're in anymore. You know, like, it's gone from being the underdog to being, well, you know, the overdog or whatever it is. The big dog.
The overdog.
The big dog. And, you know, I think there's a sort of different set of, you know, people aren't as sort of as defensive about it as Apple as they used to be. In fact, you know, it's kind of the opposite. In fact, you know, like, I was telling this story in the beginning of the book. Remember Dave Kravitz, Lewis at Wired?
Yeah.
So Dave was one of our colleagues.
Absolutely.
And he was a reporter there at Wired. And when he came in, you know, like he hated Apple. He hated Steve Jobs. He couldn't stand anything to do with Apple. And he just needled me about it. Like, he would do this literally every single day. He'd come in and say, "Hey, Ali, you know, how's your iPhone working out? You know, how do you like to be told, but what to look? How do you like, you know, your iPhone being, your home screen being told, you know, what its layout by Steve Jobs, you know?" And then he'd show me his Android and how he could do anything he wanted on it and all that kind of stuff. And he hated Steve Jobs. He hated being told what to do. He felt the company was sort of too heavy-handed in sort of locking down its device. He thought the one-button mouse was crazy, you know. And he would just do it to wind me up and every single day. And then he gets an iPod
like
for Christmas or his birthday, you know, from his girlfriend. And he didn't really want to use it, but, you know, he wanted to keep her happy. So you know, he starts using it just to keep her quiet. And, you know, guess what? He falls in love with it. And then the next thing you know, he's down at the Apple store every single day, and he's checking out the MacBooks and he's checking out the iPhones, and then he has this weird, it's like a, you know, when someone gives up smoking or drinking, you know, like a reformed smoker, there's nothing more irritating than a reformed smoker, because they start evangelizing. So every single day he's coming in and he's telling me about his f***ing iPod and how much he loves this thing. And I'm like, yeah, Dave, I already have one, you know, I know. So, but it's this sort of like, you know, it gets its hooks into people, and he became like really obsessed with Apple. And I thought that was a good illustration of that kind of mentality, you know, of like what happens to people when they become Apple fans.
Well, and so many people, the iPod is their gateway drug.
That was a similar story to what happened to me. I was a hardcore PC guy. I was that guy in the PC ads. That was me. I mean, I was cooler and in better shape. I was the PC. I was the PC. I was a hardcore PC fan.
The one with Justin Long. I mean, you were.
Yeah, those ones.
Hodgman, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I would go as far as I would persecute people that were big into Apple, and I thought they were morons. I thought they were just falling for Apple's slick marketing. Yeah. You know, all the stuff that you still hear even now. And then I had to use a Mac for work, and boom, fell in love with it, and here we are now. Got an iPod
podcast
after that. You know, it's like, look what happened. Yeah, so it's probably not an uncommon story, I would guess, is people make fun of people who are hardcore Apple fans, and then they use a device, and they see why people love the devices so much and why there's like this big community of people that do weird stuff like write a whole opera just about Steve Jobs.
Talk about a segue.
I'm too good. David, tell me about the Steve Jobs opera, because I have to say this is one of the stories I actually hadn't heard, and I would love to go see a Steve Jobs opera. Is everyone wearing like New Balance shoes and those half mock neck turtleneck shirts and stuff?
The set is incredible. The way they designed it to look like an operating system with all the icons and yeah, the mock turtleneck, the tennis shoes, they're all there.
Oh, it is there.
They even found an opera singer, a baritone, who halfway looked like Steve Jobs. He had the good beard. They gave him some little glasses, happened to be bald. And the opera was called The Revolution of Steve Jobs. Mm-hmm. And the R is in parentheses because the whole opera is about his evolution as a human being. It was kind of interesting because it came out at a time, the last movie about Steve Jobs, a biographic movie on Steve Jobs, was panned by all the...
You mean the Ashton Kutcher one?
Yeah. Well, not the Ashton Kutcher one, but the The one that was made by...
Danny Boyle, yeah. Fassbender, Michael Fassbender.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, and so all the Apple fans hated that, thought it, you know, basically focused on the dark side or the prickly side of Steve Jobs. And so the opera, the librettist, Mark Campbell, wanted to write something that was, you know, a little more nuanced, a little more layered. And basically the whole thing is about how Steve Jobs, you know, goes from this prickly, hard-ass, hard-driving boss into more of a human being. It debuted in New Mexico.
The heart of opera.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because that opera house is actually an outdoor theater, and then you've got the lights of Los Alamos in the background.
The glowing nuclear sound.
Yes, exactly.
Did you see the opera, David?
I did not.
Did you hear any of it? Because it would really help
me
if you could maybe sing a few bars for us.
I wish I could.
Does it sound like, you know, classic opera, or is it sort of more avant-garde?
It's more avant-garde, definitely. But I mean, you definitely know you're at an opera. I would sing you a few bars. My wife says that there's an opera singer in me dying to come out.
Oh, really?
Let's
let him out now.
I'm not prepared to sing. Now, had you told me we need you to sing a few bars, I might have practiced beforehand.
Oh, well, that's a seriously missed opportunity, because I think that would really add the context that we need here and get people's appetites wet for the Steve Jobs opera.
Let's do it next week.
Okay.
Yeah, you would come back and sing a few bars of the Steve Jobs. In fact, maybe next week we can just devote the whole episode and we'll just give David the mic and he can just sing the whole opera.
Sing the way through it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure our audience will stay tuned for the entire episode next week.
But they found this opera, they cast a tenor that looked like Steve Wozniak.
Wow. I think a lot of tenors look like Steve Wozniak, though. He's kind of got like that operatic
Pavarotti
look.
Yeah, it looks just
you know,
like
exactly.
a woman that was cast to play Lorene Powell Jobs.
Yeah.
She, you know, that's a big part of the story, is how she helped him grow as a human being. And the guy who wrote the opera, he didn't see any of the movies. He didn't read any of the books.
That's good. So he just did his own original thing.
Yep. And the opera was just one story of many in the book regarding how the art world has kind of been inspired by Jobs, especially since his passing. And so there are all these different pieces of art, graphic designs, tattoos, sculpture, relief sculpture with broken pieces of Apple devices. That, you know, and it's all, you know, it kind of a tribute to Steve Jobs, but also some commentary on the world that Apple has kind of created.
I got to get myself like a Steve Jobs bust or something. That'd be pretty cool. I don't know if they sell something like that, but can you imagine like a bust in your house?
If you Google it, I'm sure it's out there.
Yeah. I have a Steve Jobs like figurine.
Yeah.
You do?
About 6 inches high, yeah.
Oh, where'd you get that?
Some guy sent it to me from China, and he was selling them, but Apple shut him down.
I was just gonna say, didn't they get shut down? Because
yeah,
it was pretty lifelike, right?
Pretty quickly, yeah. It's really cool. It's a good one. You have glasses. His Lennon glasses. What do you call those things? Silver rim glasses. You can actually sort of tip them up onto his forehead. You know, like he used to do when he was looking at his iPhone.
Yeah.
So that was pretty funny. Well, it came with a little iPhone, too, in his hand and some other little accessories.
You know what's interesting, kind of a short aside here, is that Apple would shut down someone making a figurine that uses Steve Jobs' likeness because his likeness is gone, right? As far as I know, using someone's likeness is okay if they are no longer with us. So, and it's also interesting that Apple would be the one that would be pursuing them because it's not Apple's property, I don't think. If anything, it would be... like Lorene Powell Jobs's property. But with Steve Jobs no longer with us, why would anyone come after you for that? You're just using someone's likeness who doesn't, I don't know, for lack of a better way of describing it, who isn't able to enforce the law around likeness anymore. So it's interesting that they came after you. And actually, I know someone who was doing some products that included Steve Jobs' likeness, and Apple contacted this person as well and asked this person to stop, which I was surprised to hear.
This is after his death?
Yes, yes. They asked him to stop. And when he was talking to them, well, I won't go into it anymore because I don't want to give away too many details, but I was surprised to hear that they contacted him and politely suggested that the product not be sold anymore. And I was like, whoa, dude, Steve Jobs is gone. Like, why would Apple be calling you about that? Anyway, so FYI, if you're thinking about creating a Steve Jobs doll that you're going to be selling online, you'll be hearing from Apple's lawyers, I would guess. Let's talk about Kansas Fest, David, the world's largest gathering of Apple nerds and all that goes on at an event like that. What kind of debauchery is happening at Kansas Fest? Let's cut straight to the chase. Is there like some kind of weird orgy that happens at the end where everyone's dressed like Steve Jobs?
Micro soldering and all night hacking.
You should explain that Kansas Fest is an annual, I think it's the longest running computer conference.
I mean, what other electronics device has a festival devoted to it?
And it's for the Apple II, which was discontinued in, when was it discontinued? 92?
Yeah, it's like 91, 92. The Apple II was the first mass-produced computer by Apple, designed by Steve Wozniak. And what makes this computer special is that it was an open architecture. And so you could go in and you could upgrade your computer, you could hack it, you could write programs for it. And all that changed when the first Macintosh came out in 84. And in fact, if you go to Kansas Fest, you will meet people who never bought another Apple device again.
Well, they're true to that phrase, the Apple II forever, right? Which is the marketing slogan for the Apple II. And it's true. You know, these people really are Apple II forever people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a week-long festival in Kansas City. It's been going on for about 30 years, I would say. And, you know, the very first day is kind of this free-for-all. They set up all of these monitors, keyboards, software, bits and pieces of, you know, the peripheral devices, the hard drives, and people can run and grab whatever they need. So these are like donated items. And so people can, you know, build the computer they want. And so it's just this frenzy. They set everything out in the middle of this big room and they say, on your mark, get set, go.
Whoa.
And it's, you know, it's like, remember that 10, you know, the 10 minute shopping spree you would get at
Toys
R
Us? I was just thinking that. Yeah.
It's just like that.
So people just running around, punching each other, pushing, biting, reaching, grabbing, taking the Apple II parts they need. And it's just Apple II stuff?
Just Apple II stuff. There's a few other things there. I mean, there's you know, people who want to get rid of like that first Macintosh, but usually that stuff is not what they go for. They go for some, you know, software that they, you know, have always wanted, or, you know, a certain kind of keyboard. Yeah, it's really a fun little event.
There's still people that make software for the Apple II, which is kind of incredible.
There are people that are still writing programs, games. They're hacking their Apple IIs to run internet. And so it's really interesting how, you know, there's a lot of emulation software that people will run on some of their other computers. And there's even a guy who has his own formula for taking this, you know, the hard plastic housing that turns kind of beige over time.
Yeah, it gets like that weird yellow color.
Retro bright. He's got this solution that's like hair salon strength bleach and OxyClean and a whole bunch of stuff. And he'll take apart people's computers and then he'll just go out in the sun and clean it off. And what happens is the sun kind of reverses the process and takes that beige cast and removes it, and it's a much whiter computer, like it had just come off the factory online.
Yeah, so, almost as good as new, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's an interesting group of people. I mean, you had people who are gay, straight, trans, Hillary supporters, Trump supporters, and they all leave that at the door, and they just bond over their love of Apple II. You know, a lot of these folks were they were in high school, and their computer lab had that Apple II, and they'd play Oregon Trail or some other game. Yeah. And, you know, there was one guy in particular who, he felt kind of awkward. He didn't have many friends, and he would go in at lunchtime into the computer lab and play like Oregon Trail and other games. And it really, you know, he became a computer programmer. I mean, it was a really transformative experience for him. It's like his first love, and he married his first love, which was his Apple II.
It's an Apple
II. I mean, literally, he married his Apple II.
A yellowing one now, yeah, as well.
So, I mean, yeah. So there are all kinds of stories like that.
There's actually quite a few people showed up, Dave, right?
You know, there's usually, you know, I think when I was there a couple of years back, there were like 70 folks, you know, and then they have like a host of speakers, editors of now defunct Apple magazines.
Well, there's still an Apple magazine going, Juiced. We get it. It's quarterly. It still gets sent to the office here.
Yeah, exactly. There's some old user groups that still come together at this thing. There were people from Australia, people from Germany, I mean, and obviously from all over the United States. There is a similar festival that goes on in France, and there's also one that goes on in Australia, obviously not called Kansas Fest.
That's called Ozfest, isn't it?
Yeah, one of them is.
Okay, well, let's move on here because we got two stories left, and we're already running low on time, so we got to move on. Let's talk about Alex Jason, the teen who used his lawn mowing money, I remember this story, to build one of the most rare and impressive collections of Apple devices in existence. He built like a whole warehouse full of stuff, but he had nowhere to put it, right? Like, he was trying to figure out what to do with all this stuff.
So yeah, his home, and he lives in Maine, and the entire basement turned into an Apple museum. He started out as I think he was like 14 when he got his first Apple computer. He wanted a computer obviously to do homework, but then he also wanted something to tinker around with.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he was 10 when he found his first iMac G5 on Craigslist, and he sold his mini bike and a snowblower.
What? He sold his mini bike.
I can't believe he'd part with a snowblower.
Hey, have you ever been to Maine in the wintertime?
Yeah.
Yeah, snowblowers are
essential kit.
Essential,
huh?
Exactly. And so 5 years later, you know, he's got an Apple One. He's got original copies of Steve Wozniak's what were called WozPacks, uh-huh, which were coding notes for the Apple II.
Whoa!
He had more than 250 pieces in this basement of his.
His parents' basement, you mean?
His parents' basement, I should say. Yeah. And it started to take over a lot of his house, and he had this dream where he wanted to start a museum. He even had a building all ready that had been donated. It was an old Carnegie library in Maine, but it just, they couldn't raise enough money to do it. And so he wound up selling his entire collection to probably the biggest collector in this community of collectors. His name is Lonnie Mims, who has a museum in the Atlanta area. And Mims kind of made this arrangement where he'd buy everything, but he let Alex keep his Apple One.
Oh.
Do you know how much he got that for? Because those things are selling for what? Didn't one just sell for some crazy sum?
Yeah, I think the record for an Apple One is like $900,000.
Wow.
And this one he had, I mean, he had the provenance for it. It was owned by some guy who, I guess, took it to an IBM conference. It was in a briefcase, and he just opened it up and started typing and kind of created a scene. So that was the Apple One he had. And the collection that he sold, he was able to sock away most of the money he was going to need for college. I think he bought a pickup truck.
What about a new snowblower?
I got a new snowblower, yeah. But he had a lot of...
Got a gold-plated one.
He had a lot of valuable prototypes.
Well, he had prototypes too. That would be very cool. I would love to have some Apple prototypes.
The book also profiles a guy who all he does is collect prototypes. Now I think Alex is starting to rebuild his collection because I think there was a, he had a certain level of sadness that he had to let go of this great
collection.
But he felt that it was going to a good home, that it was going to be displayed properly in this museum near Atlanta. You know, now he's slowly building his collection up. His museum was called Alex's Apple Orchard.
Did he say how much money he got for his collection when he sold it?
He did not. And I think, you know, suffice to say, if he was able to sock away enough money where he's not worried about college, and he was able to buy a pickup truck, I think he did okay.
Yeah, and don't forget about the gold-plated snowblower.
Yeah, the gold-plated snowblower.
Those are not cheap. A regular snowblower is like $1,000. You get it gold-plated, and now you're looking at
But, you know,
10,
we get to the story about him and really his father, because his father, you know, did everything he could to help his son, you know, collect and pursue his dream. But there's a lot of great pictures in the book of some of the pieces he had, like, clear, you know, these clear shots, which is a term for a prototype that has that clear plastic where you can see all the internals. And those are usually what
cool.
The prototypes, you know, had kind of a clear plastic around them. So he had like Newton's, he had like the first MacBooks. He has like a clear shot, like a green clear shot Mac. I mean, it was really, it's really, really a cool, he had an Apple Lisa. I mean, he had every important piece.
And he's just one of quite a few collectors that we profile in the book, right, Dave? There's quite a few, there's some really interesting museums. There's one in Italy that is kind of, that's run by, that's a pretty big museum. And they don't, how many days they open it? Like 3, 4, 5 days a week? And
yep.
It's all volunteers that run it?
There's a museum in Prague. There's the museum in Atlanta. And, you know, this is what's really interesting is this is, all in response to, you know, Apple has kind of famously said that they're focused on the future and they have no interest in doing a museum of any kind. And so these kind of people have kind of taken it upon themselves to be like the docents of Apple history. And they have these great collections that they share with the public. It's just not in the places you'd expect. You know, you'd think, wow, there's probably a great Apple museum in Cupertino. You know, no, one of the best ones is in Prague in the Czech Republic.
That's so weird. It seems like a massive mistake for Apple to not embrace their own history. They should have a big museum on campus somewhere where people can go and reconnect with where they came from.
You know, and maybe one of these days they will, but, you know, right now they seem to have no interest in that. And
yeah, it's so strange.
Every once in a while when you kind of tune into the Worldwide Developers Conference or product launch, they'll make some nod to, you know, some glory day, a time when, you know, there was a great, you know, that first iPhone, or they'll make some reference to the past. But beyond that, they really are, it's really a forward-thinking company.
Sure. I understand that, but they got so many billions, you know, come on, Tim. Slop together a museum of some kind. Maybe cost you $500 million.
No other brand has a devoted community of consumers like Apple. And I would think that a museum would be something that would make sure that, you know, kind of feeds that thing that people need from Apple. You know, that they feel connected to it.
I totally agree. And I think it's a mistake to neglect that and ignore your entire history and the fans who love the products that you've come out with over the past 30 years and let somebody else do that. Let some kid who mows lawns collect all that stuff and put it in his basement where no one gets to see it. It seems like something like Apple should have bought that stuff and created their own museum. Anyway, I repeat myself. That's a very cool story. And a lot of this stuff is, there's lots of cool pictures of all these things within the book, right? So they can see all these collections and all the different pieces and that kind of thing. That's kind of what makes the book special, isn't it? Is the big images, the imagery that is included all throughout the book, that is included with all these stories. That gives you that feeling of camaraderie with all the other Apple fans that are out there and doing cool things with Apple products or doing cool things in the Apple ecosystem. Don't you think, David?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, if you can't hold these things in your hand, the pictures in this book is like the next best thing.
If you can't hold them in your hand, the book will help you hold them in your heart. That's a freebie. Is it too late to put that on the jacket?
A bit too late, yeah, but anyway.
Second printing.
Yeah, second printing for sure.
And I was just looking at some of the pictures just on the website that I guess are in the book. And yeah, it's kind of awesome seeing all these things lined up, you know, these all those different iMac G3s and all those different colors. And those prototypes are really wild. Those clear shot prototypes, that green Mac or whatever it is.
And how many, you know, how many of those are out there?
How do those even get out into the world? I mean, it seems like Apple would hunt you down and you know, kill you or something if you.
Yeah, so Alex and his father would travel to these vintage computer festivals, and you know, he happened to meet some of former Apple engineers, and in some cases, you know, they said, "Hey, I've got this prototype of a product we worked on, and I think I was cleaning out my closet and want you to have it."
You'd think that would be Apple's property. I mean, I'm kind of surprised they don't.
I was just thinking, yeah, so they stole it,
track them down, and put everyone in jail.
You'd be like reaching to hand the product over, then all of a sudden a dart would hit you in the neck. And then a white limousine would squeal up to the front of your house. Tim Cook would get out with a white cane, and these Apple guys dressed in all white would cart you off with your prototype.
Yeah, right. I mean, one of the profiles in the book is on a guy by the name of Hap Plain, who collects nothing but prototypes. And this is the guy who has the two prototypes with the two different operating systems for the first iPhone.
Wow.
And you remember there was that competition between the two people on the team. You know, there was, you know, Steve Jobs kind of turned this thing into a competition. And so one of the operating systems had that little scroll wheel like on an iPod. And then the other one is closer to the OS that we know today. And he has prototypes that run both of these.
That's got to be worth some serious ducats.
For the longest time, I mean, people knew that they were out there, and he would occasionally anonymously share like little videos of these two working prototypes. And only recently, you know, has he come out as the guy who owns those. Oh. And that was on the anniversary of the iPhone, the big anniversary, the 10th.
Okay, look, we're running low on time here. So we could keep going on this story for a while longer because there's a lot here, but let's move on. Let's talk about the man who built a career pimping out the iPhones of the rich and fabulous, because he's using gold, he's using feathers, he's using all sorts of rare animal skins that I've never seen before, and it looks like he's making himself a fortune.
So the name of the company is Aurum Edition, started by a guy named Dmitry Lyshina. And there are a number of companies, jewelers, that gold plate iPhones, Apple Watches, any device you want, they'll take care of you. And in fact, there's a couple in Russia. What's interesting about Dmitry is he was in the Ukraine and he started gold plating phones in his garage. And he learned gold plating from this old guy that did it for a number of years. And he started by really wanted this Nokia phone. And when he finally got it, he gold plated it.
As one does.
And so he would, you know, walk around town with this thing, show it off. People thought that was cool. And then soon they started giving him their phones to gold plate, you know, and then not long after that, the iPhone became more available in a place like the Ukraine. And so he, you know, this from a garage, probably a poorly ventilated garage, came this business. And, you know, he's selling these phones for like $4,000. And these are not cases. you know, he takes the, you know, the housing and has a process that plates or galvanizes the gold to the phone.
So it's like a permanent, it's like a permanent fixture on your iPhone. Whatever he adds is there forever, right?
Yeah, it, yeah, absolutely.
they actually look better than you'd think. Then you think it's from the description, it sounds kind of tacky, but they, I mean, some are a bit tacky, right? Kind of like a gold-plated Trumpian toilet, but
I wouldn't mind having one of those.
Some of them aren't so bad, actually. I thought some of them looked pretty classy.
Gold relief snake dragon, whatever that is, on the front. It looks a little over the top, but yeah, there are some really elegant, you know, models that they produce.
I mean, it looks like he's creating custom iPhones for Russian drug lords from the pictures that I saw, like with the dragons and the feathers and like all like the ostrich skin on there. The phones don't look like phones that most normal people would want to own. They're highly elaborate works of art, really. And I mean, it's like the same kind of guy who would want to have his 9mm encrusted in jewels and silver. He, like, that guy also has his iPhone pimped out by this guy in the story. In fact, he might even give you like a discount. He'll do your gun and your iPhone in the same order, you know?
The only people buying these are oligarchs and Russian hockey players in the NHL.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, they look cool. They look cool, but they're very elaborate works of art. And he charges a lot of money for these, doesn't he?
You know, he's of the companies that do this, he's more on the affordable side. You know, a higher end phone from his company is about $4,400. But there is a company in St. Petersburg, Russia, that is famous for making these gold iPhones with Putin's mugshot on them. Every time Putin sneezes, it's a historic event and they commemorate it with a phone. They're doing things like putting pieces of the first manned spacecraft on their phone and selling it for like $30,000. They're like this guy times 10.
Why do all these places seem to be in either Russia or Eastern Europe? Is it just Eastern Europeans and Russians who want to have their iPhones pimped out in this way and are willing to spend $5,000 to do it? It's like every single one of these places is somewhere over there.
Yeah, there's two or three big companies in Russia. There's a company in Finland that, you know, will even like put pearl inlay in the phones. There's companies in the Middle East. You know, so there's got to be a demand for it.
I'm just telling you right now, if I could get a gold-plated Tim Cook face on the back of my iPhone with jewels as his eyes, maybe like two topaz or something, I would pay you $10,000 for that. I'll sell my car, and then I'll borrow another $8,000, and I'll have enough.
Because you don't have a snowblower, right?
I don't have a snowblower to sell. We don't. It doesn't snow here.
Your favorite rapper, Drake, spent like $300,000 to have a case made for his iPhone 10.
Dear God.
That has
$300,000.
Has like 1,000 little blue diamonds, and then it's got in the middle is his the owl that he is part of his little brand, all in diamonds. I mean, it's just crazy. So,
if I had $10 million, I the last thing I would ever purchase would be a case for my iPhone or any kind of galvanized embellishments for my iPhone. That's literally the last thing on my list.
You feel pretty cool when you got a nice OtterBox on your iPhone. You know, you don't, but that's only $40 or what?
Yeah, I think maybe $40 might be my max for a case. You know what I'm saying?
No, exactly.
I can't believe I've never seen that Drake thing. My God, that's so goofy looking.
I wrote about it this year.
Don't you read Cult of Mac, Lewis?
Every once in a while, I miss something. It looks like something you'd see on Etsy or something.
Well, there's some jeweler in LA that does all the iPhones for the stars.
It's like that Jeff Goldblum show I was just watching. He goes and he has that shoe episode I was telling you guys about. He goes to a guy who makes custom sneakers for all the celebrities in Hollywood. So like you show up and the guy asks you questions about your life, and then he will build you a pair of custom shoes. He made some for Kobe Bryant, and there's like this huge list of celebrities that he's built custom shoes for. And then at the end of the episode, Jeff Goldblum unveils his custom Goldblum shoes.
What do they look like?
They looked okay.
nice build.
They
up.
Had like zebra skin on the inside, which was pretty cool. I mean, I could get into that. And they had like some insignia that had some kind of nostalgic value to Jeff Goldblum. I don't know. I mean, what I wouldn't pay $20,000 for him, but I'm pretty sure he got them for free. All right. Well, These are only some of the stories that you're going to find in the rich tapestry of the Cult of Mac 2.0. How many pages is it, David? It's like
I have no idea.
Pages.
Hold on, I got a copy here. Let me see.
Break it open. Let's hear how many pages it is.
Because he has top billing, he got a copy before I did.
Yeah. So, Leander, you finally got some copies in house.
I don't think I'm going to get a copy at all. No starch is so cheap, David. I'm surprised they send you one, actually.
You're going to have to order them on Amazon yourself.
Right. At full price.
Can I have a discount? I wrote it.
Is there a big Black Friday discount?
Okay, it's 207 pages.
207 pages!
All full color, all beautifully designed. It's a nice book. It's a really nice book. It's something really to be proud of.
It does look like a MacBook. I saw it on your lap the other day. I thought it was a MacBook.
Yeah, I don't want to leave it in the car, you know, like
Definitely don't.
No, someone's going to break in and steal it.
I was trying to send an email on it. I thought your computer was broken.
Right.
Well, you can order it from Amazon.com. I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to check it out. And, of course, you'll get yourself a wonderful, beautiful book that documents all the stories from the Cult of Mac. And you'll be sliding a few of those sweet green ducats right into LK's pocket. I don't know if there's any space left because he's got a lot of ducats in there.
Plus, they're pretty tight pockets.
It's a tight pocket. even in those Costco dad jeans, there's not a lot of space left for the ducats because his pockets are full. But he'll make some space just for you. So you'll be supporting Leander and Cult of Mac, of course, and you'll also be getting yourself a pretty cool book, if I do say so myself. In fact, I'm going to see if I can get one that's signed from LK. He told me he'd give me a discount.
Oh, shit, I did, didn't
knock
I?
Knock off
yeah.
a couple bucks. He said he'd knock off a couple bucks, but then I think he padded the shipping price, so I'm not going
to. He'll send you the Amazon link for Christmas.
There you go. Let's go ahead and wrap it up there because we've been going for almost 3 hours now, and we could do this all day. We could do this all day, but alas, it's time to get going and get our hands on some of that sweet, sweet turkey meat. We got the white and the dark coming up, and I like them both.
And the giblets pack.
Don't forget about the giblets, which is David's favorite part. He just sucks those giblets right out of the bag. All right, let's go ahead and wrap it up there. That's all the Cultcast we have for you guys this week. If you want to come say hi, we're all on Twitter. I'm at Arif on ERFON. Lewis is at Lewis Wallace. Leander is at L. Caney. David, are you on Twitter?
I am not.
You're not on Twitter. Okay, well, you can just
yeah,
go outside and just call his name into the air and maybe he'll hear you. All right, that's all the podcasts we have for you guys this week. I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you guys next time. Oh, I forgot the Thanksgiving wrap up. Here we go. Ready? Here it comes.
Gobble, gobble, y'all!
Ooh, Tim. He made a delicious bird this year. He sent me a text of it. He was in his apron. It was a dark brown bird. Big mountains of mashed potatoes. Eddie Q was there. He was sticking his fingers in the mashed potatoes. Tim Cook was obviously very agitated about that.
If I ran into Scarlett Johansson in a Tokyo bar, I might be inclined to sit and talk to her there, too.
Yeah, I would, too.
Well, they were in a hotel bar with no one else in it,
right? Not
the
worst option.
Yeah.
I really liked that movie. I thought it was charming.
I remember liking it.
I remember hating it.
Well, most people like it, Lewis. That's why.
Yeah.
That's precisely why he doesn't like it. I do understand that whole Bill Murray, thing, how he's like larger than life now, and his his Bill Murray cool personality is always what
it's not so much him, it's the way that people revere him. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That's what sort of irritates me. That kind of like that Bill Murray, blank Bill Murray hero worship just gets on my
He's a man of the people.
Well, is he?
He shows up in random places and does cool things.
Like what? He was smoking a cigarette in a hotel lobby or something, right? And someone took a selfie with him.
I heard that he like shows up at people's parties. This is part of the lore, see?
Yeah.
I heard that he shows up at people's parties and then like does their dishes and leaves.
See? So
Or he'll come up and he'll eat fries off your plate if he sees you at a restaurant. And then he'll eat your fries, and when you're sitting there looking at him in shock, he whispers, "No one will believe you." And then he leaves.
That would be the thing to say.
I heard that happened.
Oh,
see?
Is that the thing? Is that what he said?
I heard that actually happened, but who knows what's true anymore. Huh. That's why he's one of America's most beloved icons.
Did you watch that show, The World According to Bill Murray or something like that? No, I'm sorry. I'm kind of confused now. It was like Bill Murray's Very Special Christmas something.
No, I didn't see it.
Yeah, I couldn't bear to watch it either. But
did you see Zombieland?
Yeah, irritated me.
When Bill Murray showed up,
God.
See that role is classic Bill Murray, where he shows up and he's playing himself.
Right, exactly. Annoying.
That was so good. Annoyingly good. No. Why can't I be that good? That's what annoys me.
No.
Anyway, so yeah, Jeff Goldblum, he's turned into one of those kinds of characters where you never really know if he is pretending to be that character or if he's being himself. And it reminds me of, do you guys remember the Chevy Chase talk show?
What? No.
Okay, so it was short-lived, so that's probably why. So Chevy Chase, during the height of Chevy Chase's career, started a talk show, like a Johnny Carson-type talk show. Mm. And then it failed, I think, within 9, 10 months.
Right, because
the problem was... Well, he was playing Chevy Chase, right, in this show, and he wasn't able to just be himself. He always had to be playing Chevy Chase, and you can't play a host in that kind of role because you're supposed to be letting your guests do all the entertaining.
Right, exactly,
you're supposed to be like the backup guy.
See, but that's exactly what you get. You can tell he's an egotistical asshole. He's full of himself. He f-ing loves himself, thinks he's the f-ing greatest guy ever, and that's what makes him so unbearable.
Who, Bill Murray or Chevy Chase?
Chevy Chase.
You don't like Chevy Chase either?
Hate him.
Oh,
hate him. Cannot watch anything he's in. I can't stand his smug face.
Though.
I'd love to punch him in the fat, his fat smug face. I'd love to. I really would. I'd pay money for that, actually. I'd f***ing pay money to punch his fat smug face. National Lampoon's Christmas whatever bullshit.
That's a classic.
Party.
Christmas Vacation.
Yeah.
Christmas rubbish. Vacation, a classic.
Classic shit.
Rubbish. Oh, God.
Classic shit. You know, though... Next time you see Chevy Chase, look at the guy's chin. He was blessed with one of the greatest chins in American history. It's got like a dimple in the exact right place you'd want to have a dimple in your chin. I mean, and the dimple is exaggerated now because his face is so much bigger.
Hold on, I got to do this. Let's see, what?
Are you checking out the dimple?
Yeah, I know what you
There's
mean.
There's no
yeah,
better chin dimple.
Right.
I've never seen a better chin dimple.
It's like a belly button, right? Right in the middle of a... Because he's got like a sort of a chin nipple and then a dimple, right? So it kind of goes out and then in.
I don't remember the nipple part.
Oh, boy.
I'm looking for... Oh, yeah, there it is. Look at that dimp. Hoo, baby.
Wow, he's put on quite a lot of weight, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he's a little bigger. If I had $100,000, I would consider having... a dimple like that installed. Maybe they could take some fat. Well, I was going to say take some fat out of my rear, but it's solid as a rock, so that's not where it's coming from. Maybe from if they could find any fat on my body, just take a little bit and plump up each side.
You could have
Lewis
fat
with
from
the
my
gift.
Rear, Irfan, if you need it.
What's that?
You could have the fat from my ass if you need it.
That's very
Yeah, that's funny.
You
could take his ass transplanted onto your chin. That's a good look.
Oh my goodness, you look different. Did you change something? I got a new chin installed. It's 100% Dave's ass.